Welcome to the final installment of the Shadow of the Mothership podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, reading my story, Shadow of the Mothership. This is a story that was originally published in Amazing Science Fiction and subsequently reprinted in my collection, A Place So Foreign and Eight More, from Four Walls, Eight Windows Press, 2003. There's two more stories in this cycle that I'll be podcasting over the next couple of weeks. The first one is called Home Again, Home Again, and the last one is called The Superman and the Bug Out. And they're also all published in my short story collection. All these stories, I should point out, you can download the text of them as Creative Commons downloads, as you can with everything in my short story collection, almost everything in my short story collection, and share them around and convert them and have fun with them. I'm leaving for California on Thursday, speaking at the Ray Kurzweil Singularity Summit at Stanford University on Friday. It's completely sold out, apparently, with a waiting list, which is great news for the conference organizers. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to be giving kind of copyright and DRM-centric talk about how the singularity isn't a historical inevitability, but might be actually undermined by the copyright wars. And I suppose if they make the audio available, I'll fold that into this podcast as well. Well, today's Sunday, and it's going to be a kind of lazy Sunday, just some household chores. I think we're planning to go to the Columbia Road Flower Market, which is just around the corner from where I live here in London. It's an old Cockney flower market, and they actually tug their forelocks and call you governor when you buy flowers, which I find unbelievably cool and almost sickeningly cute. And yesterday I had the good fortune to drop down to Trafalgar Square and see the 45-ton mechanical elephant puppet that's prowling the streets of London. You know, I can't even explain it. Just, you can either look at my Flickr stream, or if you look up the Sultan's Elephant on Google, you'll find more details. It was pretty something, though. Here's the last part of the story. Hope you enjoy it. I'm on a harbor-front patio with a pitcher of shandy in front of me, dark shades, and a fab pin in my knee when the mothership comes back. I took the cure in February, slipped out and left a note so Daisy wouldn't insist on being noble and coming with, lying about my name and camping out in the ER for a week in the newly recaptured Women's College Hospital before a doc could see me. Daisy kissed me on the cheek when I got home and then went upside my head, and Tony made everyone come and see my new knee. While I was in, someone had sorted out the affairs of the process, and a government trustee had left a note for me at general delivery. I got over $50 and bought a plane ticket for a much-deserved week in the Honduras. I tried to take Daisy, but she had stuff to do. I'd beachfronted it until the melanomas came out. Then home again, only to find that the house was crime scene taped and Tony the Tiger and Daisy Duke were nowhere to be found in a month of hysterical searching. So now, on the first beautiful day of spring, after a frickin' evil gray winter of pain and confusion, I work on my tan and sip beer and lemonade until the sirens go and the traffic stops and every receiver is tuned to the emergency broadcast system. This is not a test. I flip open my comm. There's a Hubble of the mothership, whirligig and widder shins around our rock. The audio track is running, but it's just talking heads, not a transmission from the mothership, so I tune it out. The world holds its breath again. The first transmission comes a whole pitcher later. They speak flawless English, and Spanish and Cantonese and Esperanto and Navajo, just pick a channel. And they use a beautiful bug-out contralto like a newscaster who started out as an opera singer, like a Roman tyrant orating to his subjects. My stomach does a flip-flop, and I put the comm down before I drop it, swill some shandy, and look out at Lake Ontario, which is a preternatural blue. Rats with wings seagulls circle overhead. "People of Earth," says the opera singer come newscaster, "it is good to be back. We had to undertake a task whose nature is complex. We are sorry for any concern this may have caused. We have reached a judgment." "Lady or the tiger," I almost say. "Are we joining the bug-out UN, or are we going to be vaporized?" I surprise myself and reach down and switch off my comm and throw a nickel on the table to cover the pitchers and a tip, and walk away before I hear the answer. The honking horns tell me what it is. Louder even than when the Jays won the pennant. Bicycle bells, air horns, car horns, whistles. Everyone's smiling. My comm chimes. I scan it. Dad and Mom are home. They rebuild the process centers like a bad apology. The governments of the world suddenly very, very interested in finding the arsonists who were eventual heroes at Xmas time. I smashed my comm after the sixth page from Dad and Mum. Sometimes I see Linus grinning from the news screens on Spadina, and once I caught sickening audio of him, the harrowing story of how he had valiantly rescued dozens of process heads and escaped to the subway tunnels, holding out from the torch-bearing mobs. He actually said it, torch-bearing mobs, in that same goofy lisp. Whenever Mom and Dad appear on the screen, I disappear. I've got over $15 left. My room cost me a penny a night, and for a foam coffin, it's okay. Someone stuck a paper flyer under my coffin's door this morning. That's unusual. Who thinks that people in coffins are a sexy demographic? My very own father is giving a free lecture on lasting happiness in the Galactic Federation at Raptor Stadium tomorrow night. I make a mental note to be elsewhere. Of course, it's not important where I am. The frickin' thing is simulcast to every dingy, darky corner of the world. Pops, after all, has been given a Governor General's Award, a Nobel Prize, and a UN Medal of Bravery. I pinball between bars, looking for somewhere outside of the coffin without the tyrant's oration. Someone converted what was left of Roy Thompson Hall into a big, booming dance club, the kind of place with strobe lights and naked dancers. It's been so long since I was at a bar, last summer, when they first ascended to the mothership. I feel like an intruder, though I notice about a million half-familiar faces among the dancers, people who I met or shook hands with or drank with or fought with, some time in another life. And then I see Daisy Duke. 6 months have been enough for her to grow her hair out a little and do something to it that makes it look expensive. She's wearing a cat suit and a bolero jacket, and she looks sexy and kind of scary. She's at one of the ridiculously small tables, drinking and sparkling at a man in a silver vest, and some kind of skirt that looks like the kind of thing I laugh at until I catch myself trying one on. We make eye contact. I smile and start to stand. I even point at my knee and grin. Her date says something, and I see, behind the twinkle, a total lack of recognition. She turns to him, and I see myself in the mirror behind her. My hair is longer. I'm not wearing a bathrobe. I've got some meat on my bones. I'm not walking with a cane. Still, I'm me. I want to walk over to her and give her a hug, roll up my pants and show her the gob of scar tissue around my knee, find out where Tony the Tiger's got to. But I don't. I don't know why, but I don't. If I had a comm, I might try calling her, so she'd see my name, and then I wouldn't have to say it to her. But I don't have a comm. I feel suddenly like a ghost. I test this out, walk to the bar, circling Daisy's table once on the way, and again on the way back. She sees me, but doesn't recognize me both times, overhear snatches of her conversation. Competing next weekend in a black belt competition. Oh man, I can't believe what a pain in the ass my boss was today. Want another drink? And it's her voice, her tones, but somehow it doesn't seem like her. It feels melancholy and strange being a ghost. I find myself leaving the bar and walking off towards Yonge Street to the Eaton's Walmart store where Tony the Tiger worked, and fuck me if I don't pass him on the street out front, looking burned and buzzed and broke, panning for pennies. He's looking down, directly addressing people's knees as they pass him, spare change, spare change, spare change. I stand in front of him until he looks up. He's got an ugly scar running over his eyebrow, and he looks right through me. Where you been, Tony? I want to ask it. Can't. I'm a ghost. I give him a quarter. He doesn't notice. I run into Stude the Dude and hatch my plan at Tilly the Horse's funeral. I read the obit in the Globe with a pic to the two of them. They'd buried her at Mount Pleasant Cemetery with Mackenzie King and Timothy Eaton and Lester Pearson. Stude couldn't afford it. The squib said that he was going aboard the mothership the day after the ceremony. Lots of people are doing that. Now that we're members of the Confederation, we've got passports that'll take us to wild places. The streets get emptier every day. It's harder to avoid Dad's face. Stude scares the shit out of me with his eulogy. It's all in process speak. It is positively frickin' eerie. My life companion goes into the ground today. There's a long pause while he stares into the big hole in the outsized coffin. My daily road has taken me far from points of excellence, but I feel like my life has been a barrier to joy for myself and many others. But Tilly was a special someone, a lightning rod for happiness, and her presence graced me with the vision of joy. And so on. I wait near the back until Stewed finishes, then follow at a discreet distance as he makes his way back to his place. It's not something I ever would have considered doing last Halloween. The Stewed I knew would have spotted a tail in a hot second, but now the world has gone to jargon-slinging harmony, and I'm brazen as I ride along behind on my bike, down Young to Front, and up to a new building made of foam. I feel like a ghost as I watch him look straight through me, and I mark the address. I spend a day kicking at everything foam. The foam is hard and durable, and I imagine the houses of my parents' suburb, the little process enclave, surviving long past any of us, surviving as museum pieces for arsenic-breathing bug-outs who crawl over the mummified furniture and chests of clothes, snapping picks and chattering in their thrilling contraltos. I want to scream. Here and there, pieces of the old, pre-processed, pre-foam Toronto stick out, and I rub them as I pass them by. Touchstones for luck. Spring lasted about 10 days. Now we're into a muggy 32-degree summer weather, and my collar itches and sweat trickles down my neck. I'd be wearing something lighter and cooler, except that today I'm meeting my dad at Aristide. They've got a little wire-flown twin prop number fueled up and waiting for me at the miniature airstrip on Toronto Island. Dad was so glad when I got in touch with him. A real milestone on his personal road to lasting happiness. There's even one of the process heads from Young and Bloor waiting for me. He doesn't comment on all my frickin' luggage. I hit Stude's place about 10 minutes after he left for his trip to the mothership. I had the dregs of the solvent that he'd sold me, and I used that to dissolve a hole in his door, then reached in and popped the latch. I didn't make a mess, just methodically opened crates and boxes until I found what I was looking for. I hauled it in batches to the elevator, loaded it, and took it back to my coffin in a cab. I had to rent another coffin to store it all. The process head stays at the airport. Praise the bug-outs. If he'd been aboard, it would have queered the whole deal. I press my nose against the oval window next to the hatch, checking my comm from time to time, squinting at the GPS readout. My stomach is a knot, and my knee aches. I feel great. The transition to process land is sharp from this perspective, real buildings giving way to foam white and a razor-edged line. I count off streets as we fly low, the autopilot getting ready to touch down at Aristide, only 70K away. And there's my Chestnut Avenue. God damn, the wind's fierce on a plane when you pop the emergency hatch. It spirals away like a maple key as the plane starts soothing me over its PA. I've got a safety strap around my waist hooked onto the front row of seats, and the knots had better be secure. I use my sore leg to kick the keg of solvent off the deck. I grab my strap with both hands and lie on my belly at the hatch's edge and count 3 hippopotami, and then the charge on Stude's kegger goes bang, and the plane kicks up, and now it's not the plane coming over the PA, but the Roman tyrant's voice, shouting, but not loud enough to be understood over the wind. The superfine mist of solvent settles like an acid bath over my Chestnut Ave, over the perfect smile, and starts to eat the shit out of it. I watch until the plane moves me out of range, then keep watching from my comm, renting super expensive sat time on Dad's account. The roofs go first, along with the road surfaces, then the floors below, and then the structural integrity is a thing of the past, and they fall to pieces like gingerbread, furniture tumbling roly-poly away, everything edged with rough, fractal fringe. Dad's gray-faced and clueless when I land. All he knows is that something made the plane very sick. He's worried and wants to hug me. I totter down the stairway that a guy in a jumpsuit rolled up, ears still ringing from the wind and the big boom. I'm almost to the down the step when a little process troll scurries up and says something in his ear. I know what it is because he's never looked so pissed at me in all his life. I'm a frickin' genius.